I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Large retailers in Johnson County, like Walmart and Target, are trying to cut down their property taxes. It's called dark store theory, and it could be bad news for the county. Today, we revisit our conversation with the Johnson County Commission Chair about dark store theory. We'll ask how this could impact local government, including the revenues for schools, police, and fire departments. Then our friends, the ethics professors, are back. They'll assess the morality of keeping migrants seeking asylum in cages with poor living conditions, and then how we choose which cities to save from the effects of climate change. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's called the dark store theory, and it's every bit as scary for cities and counties as it sounds. Dark store theory is the argument that Walmart, Target, Menards, and other big box retailers use to dramatically cut their property taxes. The stores argue that their buildings should be assessed as if they were vacant. And in many cases, they're winning. It's a development that can have dramatic impacts on local governments that rely on the revenue to fund police and fire departments, schools, the salaries of workers, and pension programs. 2 weeks ago, in fact, the Kansas Board of Tax Appeals handed Johnson County a defeat. They ruled on a case that Walmarts there have been overvalued by the appraiser's office. It's a decision that could mean lots of lost revenue, but there's a long review and appeals process in place, so a final decision may not come for years. We first discussed the dark store theory on this show in February, and we're going to listen back to that conversation while we and the county wait for a more detailed explanation from the Kansas Board of Tax Appeals. For now, here's my conversation with Johnson County Commission Chair Ed Eilert and reporter Laura Bliss, who joined us via Skype, who's written extensively about the issue for CityLab. I started by asking Commissioner Eilert just how worried he was about the dark store theory.
The hypothetical conditions, which is the dark store theory, that many big box retailers, or all of them, desire to use, again, is hypothetical. The conditions are not real. The conditions are contrary to the economic characteristics of the property, the legal characteristics of the property, and in some cases, even the cost basis of property that was recently purchased.
You know, we're talking about the over-evaluation of properties here, Ed, by as much as 30%, even 50% you read about across the country. If this stands, how much revenue might this mean for county government going out the window?
We did some work based upon 2017 budgets, and not only big box, but other facilities that would have similar characteristics of the big box stores. And based upon that 2017 budget, it would mean a loss of revenue across the county, schools, cities, counties, all other taxing districts, about $132 million if that standard of valuation were applied across other businesses.
And needless to say, that would have a dramatic impact on the kinds of services Johnson County government could offer here, right?
Significantly, yes.
Okay, let's move on here. The tax burden then, Ed, would shift fairly considerably to homeowners then, right?
Well, those properties that do not receive the same benefit of being valued by hypothetical conditions are the ones who would have to pick up the difference. So let's say that standard of hypothetical conditions for valuation were moved across the commercial lines, offices or apartments, then that number would be even greater. And the only property taxpayers left to pay would be the residential property taxpayers.
Okay. Well, Laura Bliss, let's bring you into our conversation here. To what extent are we seeing this kind of impact all over the country right now?
So in the investigation that I did for CityLab last fall, I surveyed local tax assessors all over the country and actually all over the continent. And I found folks reporting similar kinds of appeals in at least 21 states. And by my estimation, based on that survey and conversations with other legal experts and property tax experts, the total number of these kinds of appeal are probably in the thousands nationwide.
So this is a trend across the country, Laura. No question about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say that it's really accelerated, particularly in the Midwest over the last few years. But as some of these retailers have really gained some legal success in states, not only like Kansas, but also Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, the lawyers who are representing them have kind of made it a bit of a cottage industry and taken this legal argument to other states. And so that's really how you see it spreading this way.
Okay, so in a couple of sentences, Laura, explain what dark store theory is.
Absolutely. So it's a complex issue. So I really recommend anyone who's interested in really understanding, checking out the story on CityLab. And there's also been great reports subsequently in the New York Times and in Slate. But the basic gist of it is that this is a dispute over what the value of some of the most valuable types of properties to local communities are. And in this case, we're talking about big box stores, right? So your Targets, your Walmarts, your Menards, your Meijers, right? These big, warehouse-shaped structures on the landscape that make up a really sizable share of the local tax base for many communities around the country. And basically what you have these store owners arguing is that, well, hey, local tax assessor, you're saying that my store is worth $20 million on the books. But in fact, according to the rules of local property tax assessment, you should really be comparing it to other stores on the landscape that are like it. And because these kinds of stores have been so overbuilt in the last 20 years, what you have are quite a few big box stores that are now vacant,
right,
or in some cases reused for much less valuable uses. And so the property owners are saying, well, hey, because the neighboring Walmart is now empty and only worth $2 million, well, my Walmart, even though it's thriving and totally active, should actually only be worth $10 million, about 50% less than what you have on your books.
Well, you explained that very well. I really appreciate the simplicity with which you approach that. Because, yeah, it's
good.
It's a pretty basic argument here, right?
It is. It's quite elegant, and it makes sense. But what you have the local property tax assessor saying is that, well, yes, I mean, in some cases, that is how we, decide the value of properties, but not in every case. There are other sort of approaches to, this kind of property class. And this is where it gets really wonky and I realize a little bit, eye glazing. But it's really important, right? Because local communities do rely on property tax revenues. And if you have every store, in the community arguing that, oh, well, no, you should really be comparing my property tax value to this building or this building, that really presents a crisis to communities that rely on that revenue.
Well, why wouldn't you compare apples to apples here, Laura? Why wouldn't you compare a big box store that's full and attracting a lot of traffic to other big box stores that are full and attracting a lot of traffic?
Right. Well, that is indeed part of the argument that, a local tax assessor would make. The sort of heart of this issue gets into pretty wonky, heady legal disputes about, the meaning of property and what things should be worth that I had really struggled to get my head around entirely. By the sort of best opinions I could find out there is a really legitimate dispute going on out there, which is why, you see cases getting, batted up the legal system in states now all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Ed Eilert, chime in here.
Well, let me give you a specific example.
Please.
A big box retailer along Metcalf, I won't say where, the store was sold or purchased for $20 million. It was on the county's books appraised at $10 million, purchased for $20 million. The argument presented by the owner was, no, it's only worth $5 million. Having paid $20 million, and now it's only worth $5 million, mm-hmm. Those kind of arguments that make no sense, that are based upon hypothetical conditions, are prevalent throughout the arguments that are presented. In Johnson County, I'll give you an example. There were six or seven large box stores in a group that prior to the recession in 2008, they were valued mainly in the $72, $75 a square foot. The recession, they went down to about $42, $44 a square foot, which is appropriate. And then they started coming back up to about $50, $52 a square foot when the economy began to improve. And then one of these big box of stores was sold for $144 a square foot. So the county appraiser knew that he was off his appraisal significantly, which might get him into trouble with the state. So he hired a, and it's done frequently, a third party to do appraisals on those properties. And the appraisal report came back that they should be valued in excess of $100 a square foot. So these properties went to the state, and they ended up, instead of being valued at $52 a square feet, they were about $56 or $57 a square foot. Still about half of what the independent appraisal indicated they should be valued at.
Right. But Laura, bottom line is these cases are going to court, and in some cases, the big box retailers are winning, right?
Yeah, that's right. It really seems like it's about half and half in most of the states where there's been a kind of a history of this issue. And, you know, it does sound illogical, right? I mean, the way Ed is describing it, it does sound really illogical. And counter to the sort of historic practices of most property tax assessors. But, you know, when you really sort of get into the legal weeds, it does seem like, you know, a lot of judges are siding with the retailers and saying that, oh, wait, yeah, you guys are being overtaxed. And, you know, these, the rules that are sort of applying to you guys are different than the ones that are applying to others. And so that has really led a lot of the kind of experts who are following this issue to say that state legislatures really need to clarify in their statutes, you know, how to approach these kinds of property classes so that this kind of legal loophole is closed once and for all.
Laura, I think you wrote about that in your longer piece, and I think you pointed out that even in cases where legislatures weigh in and change the law to avoid this kind of problem, the problem's not necessarily going away.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And in fact, we just saw Wisconsin's new governor, Tony Evers, just announced that his state budget proposal, which will be released sometime this month, I guess, is going to include some language for closing the loophole there, because this has been a huge issue in Wisconsin, which has, you know, thousands of little municipalities that have all been kind of hit with this kind of argument. And it's true. I mean, in Indiana is like actually the one state that has passed some legislation addressing this, but you still see appeals. And I actually think that that actually gets to, I think it really supports the argument that this dark store theory is a way for big box retailers to exploit local community governments, because you really see the glut of these kinds of issues, at least in the places where I was reporting. It's really affecting smaller communities that tend to have a little bit less of the ability to amass big legal resources to just like endlessly fight this in court. And what you're talking about is, right, like, you know, West Bend, Wisconsin going up against Walmart and Target. And these retailers are just filing these appeals year after year, even after, you know, a court case might settle it, even after a tax assessor rejects their claim, right? And it's almost like a bleeding out.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about the dark store theory, this notion that big box retailers have a way to dramatically cut their property taxes and the effect this can have on local communities and local property tax rates for homeowners. Ed, I'm wondering what your sense here, to what extent do these big box stores have a point? I mean, or from your vantage point, are they taking advantage of the system? They're using these comparable sales prices for big box stores that have gone vacant and aren't worth nearly as much as they once were. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, let me say this at the outset, that anybody who has a disagreement with their property valuation should have the right to appeal and do have the right to appeal. Right. But you need to use factual data in supporting that appeal, which the hypothetical conditions do not use factual data. And in fact, the National Appraisers Association rejects the hypothetical conditions for valuing property. There are some other instances. For instance, I'm aware of a situation in Johnson County where a big box retailer owned the property, put in a deed restriction that if that retailer was no longer there, no other big box could come in. They moved a couple of miles down the road, built a brand new, much bigger center, and said, okay, you know, my former property now has smaller businesses in it, and my new property should be valued as though my small property is.
Yeah.
You know, conditions that are created by the property owner or the retailer themselves, which would lower values unappropriately.
Yeah, the trick here, Ed, is if these big box stores win, as they have around the country, local governments then are sometimes forced to go back years and refund the supposedly excessive taxes from previous years because, hey, if it was too high in 2018, it was also probably too high in 2017 and 2016. So there's a compounding effect here, right?
Well, those property values for the year in which they are under appeal would, if the big box stores won, would have to be reimbursed, but not for years that were not under appeal, my understanding.
Mm-hmm. But Laura, you've seen that around the country, though, haven't you?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And if they win, will this dampen enthusiasm for granting tax increment financing to future commercial projects? Ed, do you see that happening?
Well, let me get back to the question that came up.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of these big box retailers in Johnson County received tax abatements to be located where they are located. I don't know what that number is, but it's just, you know, if in fact they received those tax abatements originally, they're on that property, their taxes were abated, and now they want more tax abatements. Mm-hmm. I'll use that phrase.
Yeah.
And so even though the community has invested money in streets, of fire departments, police departments, all those things that support a viable retail environment, they don't want to pay their fair share.
Huh.
I would just...
Yeah, go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, I was just going to chime in to say that, yeah, it's definitely an issue in Wisconsin where tax increment financing is a very popular way of bringing in new development. And although it's hard to quantify exactly how many of these, you know, dark store stores that are now disputing their property tax assessments are located there, I think what this speaks to is a larger story that we're really seeing play out in the national headlines right now, right? Like with Amazon, you know, HQ2 pulling out of New York City, it seems like we're kind of turning a new chapter in how American cities and communities approach big businesses that want to settle there. And I think dark store theory is just sort of another way of looking at, you know, perhaps on a more small scale in some cases, that, you know, offering breaks to very deep pocketing companies, you know, is not going to necessarily pan out in the way that the promises that they initially make, you know, make it seem.
Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, you're on the show. We're talking about dark store theory. Good morning.
My question is, I tend to wander around in this region on business, and I go to many of these small towns in Kansas and Missouri, small towns that have been pretty much the local business has been decimated. And then down the road, closer to the highway, is a large box store, Walmart or something like that. And it appears to have really impacted the commercial value of these small towns.
Right.
And my question is there an issue here because the box stores are paying less than the original businesses would? And is this having a large scale impact?
Let me get Laura to chime in here. Laura, what do you think?
to begin with, even independent of this sort of dark store theory thing, which has more recently emerged, it's true that warehouse-style retailers tend to pay a lot less per square foot than other kinds of stores, like kind of your mom-and-pop shops that might be in a more of a downtown setting, or even in the kind of like larger, shopping plaza-style developments. But I think to get back to Ed's earlier point about the tax burden shifting, right? This is what everyone that I talk to who works in the local governments that are being impacted, describe, which is that in the way their sort of taxation system works is that, well, if you have to refund Walmart and Target like thousands of dollars a year and their property valuations are being cut by millions and millions of dollars, well, they still need that property tax revenue, right? To pay for teachers and water and fire and to pave your roads and to plant trees and to keep parks running and, to keep a community going. And so one way or the other, that tax burden has to be made up by somebody else, and that may be private homeowners, and it also could be smaller business owners, right? Mm-hmm. Like the mom and pop shops that are trying to compete in the first place may end up having to pay more in property taxes so that these towns can keep running.
Okay. Gene from Waldo. Gene, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say that, this sounds like just a continued thing, another step down the road of, eventually these corporations don't want to pay any taxes, okay? And they're holding these communities hostage, Having to give somebody money back for a property value 15 years ago, I mean, that is just pure criminal insanity.
Ed?
Well, let me say this. And again, I'm not an expert, but I think going back 10 or 15 years, when a property is appealed and there's either a decision at the state level or at the court level, that covers those years that are being considered. However, we're in 2019 and the commercial property valuations went out last week in Johnson County. We still have cases from 16 and 17 that are on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So if those cases are lost, then you have to go back that far.
Hmm.
And let me say this. I the hypothetical conditions just aren't real. It's fake. And let me describe, I've been trying to think, okay, for the residential property owner, what kind of hypothetical conditions might they use? And let's use the example. You have a four-member family, two children, three-bedroom house. The kids are gone. Why shouldn't I be able to reduce the square footage of my home by the square footage of those two bedrooms that are no longer used and reduce my values? Or the couple who spends 2 months a year in Phoenix, their house is vacant. Why shouldn't their value be reduced by 1/6? That makes as much sense to me as what these big box stores are doing.
Well, Laura, we got to wrap up. But the bottom line is these big box stores are winning in court. Why?
Because they have a elegant legal argument that sadly a lot of property tax assessors are struggling to combat in clear terms. I think that is the clearest takeaway that I found in my investigation is that, although property tax assessors have their practices and their kind of historic step-by-step processes that they take, in some cases, they are struggling to explain them clearly before the judges that are deciding these cases. I think it's also really obvious that a Walmart and a Target and a Menards have, virtually unlimited legal resources, right, especially when their lawyers are often working on contingency fees and just, taking a cut on whatever cases they win. And so there's virtually no ceiling to the number of times that they can appeal these appeals. And smaller towns, definitely have a ceiling, right, to how much time and energy they can put into them.
That was my conversation with CityLab reporter Laura Bliss, who joined us via Skype, and Ed Eiler, chairman of the Johnson County Commission. An update on this story, the Kansas Board of Tax Appeals ruled 2 weeks ago that Johnson County has indeed overvalued Walmart's there by $60 million and thus overcharged the retailer millions of dollars in taxes. Johnson County has the option to challenge the ruling. For now, they've requested the board provide a more detailed explanation for how they reached their conclusion. We'll keep watching the story for developments. Coming up, it's the return of the ethics professors. Stay tuned. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, we heard from listeners and an expert on the pros and cons of Facebook. Hear that conversation and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, with a shortage of housing in this country, we look at the real estate market in the Kansas City area. What's hot, what's not in home buying on tomorrow's Up-to-Date. Well, there's a crisis at the U.S. border. No one disputes that. Federal agencies don't have enough money to deal with the impossible number of migrants coming across southern border. But does that justify keeping children and adults in deplorable conditions of overcrowding, no showers, no hot food, and no access to fresh water? What's an ethical response to the border crisis? When it's time to discuss moral principles, we bring in the ethics professors, and they are Wayne Vaught is the provost at Utah Valley University and formerly the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. He joins us this morning from Orem, Utah. Wayne, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Great to be here.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having us.
You know, Clancy, we're told that federal agencies are, you know, overwhelmed by the number of migrants seeking to enter this country. We're not able to properly care for all of them. Some people are horrified by the numbers. Some are horrified by the conditions. I'm just wondering, what's this country's ethical obligation here, given this very unusual and trying set of circumstances?
Well, there are two large value systems that we have that are in tension. One is a value system we have that revolves around the question of justice and a social contract that we've created as citizens or otherwise sort of legally occupant members of the United States of America. And we've engaged in this particular social contract with each other, which doesn't necessarily include people who have not yet been legally admitted to that social contract. The other source of values that we're worrying about is our questions we have for ourselves as a wealthy nation and just as human beings about what count as human rights and what do we owe our fellow citizens of the world? Mm-hmm. What do we owe other people just by virtue of the fact that they are human beings? And though that's the argument we're having
the
right now
at
the
national,
that's the collision that's going on, the argument that we're having. And it's, you know, it's going to be an ongoing conversation. It's taking place, as you know, in wealthy countries all over the world.
Yeah. Well, Wayne, how would you resolve that collision? What kinds of things would you weigh as you begin to think about how to proceed from this very difficult point?
Well, I think it involves a large-scale conversation. I mean, there are problems that we're having with immigration due to, I think, poor immigration policy. We have challenges at the border that we haven't really fully addressed. Clancy, I think, makes reference to one of the things I think is coming up in this debate is and how we treat the people who have come into the country unofficially, illegally, are the fact that, you know, the U.S. is still a signatory to a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so it really takes the conversation just legal obligations a person might have.
Hey, Wayne, you're cutting out on us here a little bit.
I'm sorry?
This Universal Declaration, Clancy, of Human Rights, that's got to be a factor here, right?
Absolutely. That's an attempt to articulate what we think we owe one another simply by virtue of the fact that we are human beings, mm-hmm. independent of our particular local social contracts that we form in our individual governments, our individual nations. And one thing to think about, especially the people who are working on this issue right now in philosophy, what they're talking about, they have trouble talking about nations independent of the impacts of other nations on these poorer populations. So what that means is when you think about, for example, the question of pollution,
mm-hmm.
if you live next to a company that is polluting the water that you drink, and you're not aware necessarily of the fact that they're polluting the water that you drink, and then they find out, you feel like that company owes you something for the fact that your children are in the hospital, et cetera, and this mm-hmm. is how we think. Well, when we look at these countries that are bordering ours that are very poor, we can see a history of various kinds of sort of polluting effectively that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is a kind of political pollution because we've been involved in all of their conflicts, or we are providing a market for illicit substances that are being produced in this country. We are contributing to their poverty and to their problems in a variety of ways. The most obvious, of course, that gets bandied around is global warming. These countries tend not to have created global warming, but they are suffering mm-hmm. from the fact that we have created, we're one of the principal actors.
So we have some obligation here given our own culpabilities.
Exactly. It's more than a moral obligation that we owe one another simply by virtue of the fact that we are human beings. It's a moral obligation that we have created a mess that they are, or we have been part of creating a mess that they are now trying to escape.
Mm-hmm.
So our level of obligation is a little bit higher than we might initially think.
Mm. Do you think policymakers and the public recognizes what you're talking about?
Well, they are starting to, I think, yes. These kinds of debates actually are taking place not just in philosophy departments and in people who work on issues about borders and migrant populations. They're also taking place in Washington, D.C., and I think they are recognizing that the issue is more complicated than just, okay, we have illegals who are trying to get into our country because they think our country is better than theirs, and how do we treat them in a decent way rather than an indecent way?
You know, Matt tweeted us this, 7 dead children in the last year or two, some from the flu, 0 deaths in the 10 years before that. We're certainly doing something wrong, is what he says. Yeah.
Well, this, I think, is completely non-controversial. Right mm-hmm. now, the way we are handling the issue at the border is clearly inadequate to our own moral view of ourselves. We are acting in a way that is just needlessly selfish, needlessly respectful of the fact that these people are human beings and they genuinely need our help.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question about that. Now, have we always had trouble with dealing with the southern border of this country? I think as long as there has been a border and there have been a division between haves and have-nots, we've had problems.
But not quite like this.
The problems have gotten particularly bad, yeah. It seems like, in the past few years.
Wayne Vaught, what kinds of things would you recommend that policymakers weigh here as we go about this ongoing struggle to deal with the southern border crisis?
I think you would have to look at the number of people coming in. I think you need to look at the policies around how we bring those people into the facilities where they're being housed, the conditions of those facilities. I feel you get a lot of, at least from what I'm hearing, what I'm reading, is a feeling that, well, because they're here, we really don't owe them a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're finding these really deplorable conditions being created. And I think that the policymakers just really need to take a step back and think about this not just as a practical issue of how do we treat someone who's acted illegally, but really what are the human rights perspectives? What are the challenges in the areas that these people are coming from? And how do we deal with this humanely? Because we're sending a message to the world about our treatment of people and our respect for people and our understanding of individual human rights. And so I think that that really is sort of fundamentally the question is, and I think Clancy has already sort of alluded to this, is how do we show that we treat other human beings, even in situations where there are challenges that have been in some part of their own creation. They've chosen to cross the border. But that just doesn't give us a carte blanche to treat them in any way that we want to.
You know, and
really
yet, gentlemen,
some respect.
Yeah, and at the same time, you hear this ongoing sort of retort from some folks in the country who argue that, hey, we're not adequately caring for our own citizens, so why in the world, Clancy, should we be on the hook for non-citizens who are seeking help here?
Well, I think that it's fair to say that we ought to be caring for our own citizens better than we are.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, not all of the people who are coming into the southern border are necessarily choosing to cross the border illegally, because a lot of these people are children and mm-hmm. they're coming with their parents, and we don't feel like they really have a choice. And they turn out to be disproportionately victims of these bad policies that are going on. Now, when we are treating American children badly and inadequately, which we do, we are failing morally. When we are treating children who are coming from another country badly and inadequately, we are failing morally.
Mm-hmm.
And we can be failing morally on more than one front at the same time. You know?
We can walk and chew gum, you're saying. Yeah,
exactly.
And do it pretty well. Yeah,
in fact,
yeah.
We do. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So that doesn't absolve us of our responsibility as human beings to particularly, of course, the children who are winding up in this country and don't have adequate resources and aren't being cared for adequately, and the people who have gone down there to assess the situation, who aren't, you know, the regular boots on the ground people, who are, I'm sure, just struggling to keep their heads above water, have been, mm-hmm. on the whole, duly horrified by the situation that is going on. And this
right.
is a place where we, from my perspective, we just have to be hugely grateful to the press, frankly, that they've succeeded in bringing it to the level of national debate.
Yes.
And I do think some things are going to change, because Americans are basically very morally decent people, and they're not going to stand by while little children are treated in this way.
If our listeners want to chime in here on the crisis on the southern border and how to address it from an ethical standpoint, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Wayne Vaught, the Bible and other religious denominations, other religions offer us, you know, some sort of sense of direction here. The Bible, for example, from the book of Matthew, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. So whether resources are readily available or not, the sentiment, there is sentiment there that we should always be welcoming to those that we come across, right?
I think that most religions do, in fact, embrace the idea that there's an obligation to look out for and care for those who are disadvantaged, those who are downtrodden, those who are in these very difficult situations and states, and that there is a ethical obligation to do things to help those people.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, is an underlying sentiment, regardless of what religious belief one holds. I think that there are commitments there, and I think ethically, more generally, and in more secular terms, you can talk about these same sorts of obligations, whether they be, you know, something that we've talked about many times, utilitarian or deontological approaches, the idea of personhood, what it means to be a person, how you treat persons. So I think a variety of moral philosophers have raised this issue, and certainly those who are less well off have often been identified as people we have a particularly unique moral responsibility to.
Mm-hmm. You know, Clancy, if just jumping off our conversation here, why not just open up our borders and leave them permanently open and get rid of detention centers and get rid of these ethical questions? Why not just, if this is all an issue, is the answer just opening up everything?
Well, this is one of the frustrating things about the debate to me and some friends of mine who work on the ethics of borders, is that there does tend to be a little bit of a political overreaction in that direction, the direction that you suggest. You hear these like cries, you know, frankly, absurd cries of things for like abolish ICE, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
from the extreme left and the extreme right have both done a very bad job with this border issue and the way in which they're trying to frame it. And the reason that we have to have borders is we do, in fact, need laws. We do, in fact, need social contracts. And resources are scarce.
Mm-hmm.
In even a very wealthy country, as one of the one of the people who chimed in, front of the public chimed in, pointed out, you know, we don't have enough resources, it sometimes seems, to take care of our own children.
Right.
And so that sort of follows from that, that we may not have enough resources to take care of other children mm-hmm. who are not, so to speak, our own. Now, I think that resources are very poorly distributed in our country, but this is a separate question. The truth of the matter is we don't have enough resources to solve all of the world's problems, and we have to be able to maintain the basics of a civil society. And one of the very basics of a civil society is security, national security, being able to define what your border is and to explain to people why you either are going to receive these benefits or you are not going to receive these benefits. But then when people want to come into your country, or when they suddenly find themselves in your country and didn't choose to be there, or they are fleeing a persecutor in another country, now we have to have a conversation, because we are human beings and we mm-hmm. are trying to keep up a just society, about what are going to be the constraints on how you get to join our community.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Murad from Independence, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Thank you very much. It's a wonderful topic you're discussing, and I'll be very brief.
Sure.
My observation is the people who you tend to hear say, proud to be an American, make America great, are the first ones to want to treat these people as if they're not human beings. I tend to ask the question, what if that were you? Would you want that treatment?
Wayne, pretty good question.
Exactly.
And it comes back exactly to the point that you made earlier, the treat others, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, type of religious response to this. And I a good guide here, in a situation where you find yourself in a strange country, part of the ethical qualm that people have is that they feel that, well, these people have brought this upon themselves. They're the ones that decided to enter the country illegally.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, knowing the circumstances in which these people are coming from, the horrific worlds and experiences they may have, I can't but imagine that almost every American, if they had their children in some of these circumstances, would themselves be seeking new opportunities and the best for their children. And so I think if you do put it in that context, it really does sort of change the nature of this challenge and the problem and our obligation here. These aren't people breaking into someone's house to steal their goods. These are people who many are trying to escape persecution, escape deplorable living conditions and find a better future and better world for their children.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't try and swim across a river with your 4-year-old daughter in your arms unless you have a really good reason for doing so.
Yeah. Kurt from Johnson.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Kurt from Johnson County, you're on the show with our ethics professors. We're talking about how to deal with the crisis on the southern border, the ethical way to respond to it. Kurt, good morning.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning to you all. I've been going across the border into Mexico to border towns for almost 2 decades and helping the less fortunate and building homes and orphanages and that sort of thing. So that's a baseline of my comments. However, when people come into our country, as someone so eloquently put it, we have limited resources to give everyone the benefits that we expect in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you open the borders, as some left-leaning people would suggest, in a matter of about 5 years, we would be so overwhelmed that our society would become the one that the people are coming here are leaving, because we can't, you know, there's only so many people paying taxes and so many benefits to go around, and personal responsibility is being left at the door. And my last thought is we glaze over the fact that these people are coming into our country illegally. They are illegal immigrants, not legal immigrants. And that is a slap in the face to all the many thousands of people who have gone through the process to come in legally. And the people that are coming in illegally have cut line and said, doesn't matter, I want to be here, I don't care what your rules are. And that's mm-hmm. not a real good foot to start on.
Right, right.
I'll take your comments offline.
Kurt, I appreciate that. Clancy, you're chomping at the bit.
Well, 2 points. First of all, absolutely right that given the option of coming in legally or coming in illegally. There's no question that we would all prefer it. We do have a mechanism in place. It may not be perfect, but we do have a mechanism in place for people coming in legally rather than illegally. Now, the question that we're really wrestling with is, once someone has come in illegally, what, if anything, is our obligation as a fellow human being to that person? And I don't think our ethical obligations end just because they have broken the law of coming into the country. I feel certain that we've made this much progress already in our own conversation to say we have some moral obligation to try to help these people in some way. We can imagine ourselves in their shoes.
And you're saying, given their sense of desperation here, the scene you just described with the dad taking his four-year-old daughter across the river.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also, the caller points out through his own activity he's been engaged in helping people on the other side of the border, something that isn't sufficiently part of this conversation, which is, what would a more enlightened border policy look like? Because if we have helped create these problems in other countries, then it seems to me we have an obligation to try and help them, not just by building a really tall wall, but help them to improve their own countries so that we don't have the situation where people are fleeing. And we have the ability to do that. We've done it before.
You're talking about doing things like what?
Doing things like helping them with their education, helping them with their infrastructure, helping them with their farming, helping them, as we did in Vietnam, as we did in Germany, as we did in Japan, as we've done many times through the course of history, help them to rebuild their country so it's a good place to be rather than a bad place.
And again, a lot of folks might be thinking right now, we have so many of those problems in our own country. You want to export our expertise elsewhere at such a critical time.
Well, it's true. We are always going to have problems at home, and we always have had problems at home, and yet we've managed to improve our country and in the past help other countries improve themselves.
Ryan from Gardner on the Kansas side. Ryan, good morning.
Hey, morning, guys. Totally agree with all your discussion on the moral obligation that we have. I self-define myself as extreme left, probably, and I just wanted to clarify the thought on why getting rid of ICE is a good idea. And it's totally not abolishing borders or getting rid of or starting an open border policy. It's comes from a point of that it began, you know, recently, and it's almost a unneeded branch, as we've had border control for 80 years, no problem. Mm-hmm. And the organization seems to have been founded with a culture of, you know, hatred's a strong word, but of dislike of these people. And as we're talking about, you know, they're not an enemy just because they've come to our country.
So you want to abolish ICE, Ryan?
Well, I think that we should at least, yeah, I'll go with that. I think that we have the CBP already, and we have plenty of ways to enforce our borders without this group particularly.
Let me get a comment from Wayne Vaught. I got about 20 seconds, Wayne. Something brief, please. Abolish ICE.
20-second brief. I think that there's a lot of conversation about what we could and should be doing, and a pretty broad swath. I think that we're just talking, at least initially, about some minimum standards of human decency. And I think that the fear is that's just not what we're seeing right now.
Right. Okay, that's the voice of Wayne Vaught, the provost at Utah Valley University, formerly the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. Clancy Martin also joined us, a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Gentlemen, always great to have you. Wayne, good to hear your voice.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Good to see you. Good to hear. Bye-bye.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date. Tomorrow, find out what it takes to buy a house in the Kansas City real estate market these days. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.